Okay, so this is open space, and Jason has four rules, but they're written over there and they're too far away for me to read. But it's something about I'm not going to talk unless we're having a discussion. So I don't have another speech to give. It's really a chance for you guys to chime in and chat and talk about whatever you want to talk about. I'll just try to kick it off and say, okay, what do you think?
You were awesome.
I was awesome. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, everybody. Have a good afternoon. Lunch is over there.
If we go out and buy that HP computer.
Which HP? The Touch Smart? Yes.
How is it like a nightmare to install Win 7 like right on the hardware? Like tomorrow?
Tomorrow it isn't. Okay, certainly. You're right. I should have done that. He asked about using the HP hardware that we happen to have on stage. So touch is an interesting technology in that there are many different implementations for the actual physics of touching the screen. We're all familiar with like ATM machines. Those are pressure-based touch. So that's why you can't really do drag and drop on an ATM machine, because you can't keep the pressure even as you cut across. There's also the one that you've seen in Surface, which is using cameras and infrared. And so it's super cool, but it requires a lot of gear. And then what the HP has is one that's based on sort of a radio grid that you cut across. There's also one on the Dell Latitude notebook that also uses a specific type of technology. And it's fascinating in that they all have their pros and cons of, you know, screen size, battery draw, and things like that. And so the HP one is one of the ones that currently works with Windows 7. And also the physics of it is, what?
Works.
Yeah, it works, as opposed to not working. So it currently works. And the other part that's tricky is multi-touch. So the hardware is multi-touch, but there are going to be driver updates to support the multi aspect of it. So most of them work super well with single touch. The existing ones will work super well with single touch Windows 7. But obviously the drivers will need to be updated because they didn't know to expect to have to send up the stack multi-touch interface.
And when do you expect the Surface SDK to permeate this world?
Well, the Surface capabilities, when do you expect the Surface? I was doing it by saying Surface. The Surface capabilities are definitely related, and what we've done in Windows 7 is try to bring them relatively close to each other in capabilities. But the interfaces itself are much richer in Windows for developers. You can actually get hold of the velocity and a whole bunch of other touch information. We have specific sessions here this week that go into the details that we expose. And then as Julie talked about, you can write an application that doesn't know anything about touch, and it picks up all the WM mouse messages and translates them into touch. You can do just a little bit of work and handle a couple of the touch messages for like bottom of screen scrolling or things like that. Or you can just build a touch specific user interface. Actually, you saw Scott Guthrie do some of that as well. Or use that for your application. So there's a whole bunch of capabilities. I definitely suggest going and seeing the session. Also, over in the booth that we have is a 42-inch panel that's touch capable. And we have one of those in our hallway, and we use it for Media Center, because we've done special enabling work for Media Center, so that like when you're going through the DVD guide, you do stuff like that. When you're going through the program guide, you swoosh and stuff. And it's really, really cool to do that stuff as well. What else do folks think? Sure. So what do we think that people will be most surprised by who install the code that we are distributing here at the conference? So the first thing you might is, you know, we're distributing it here at the conference for people, and also at the conference next week, the Windows Hardware Engineering Conference, or WinHack. And that's the distribution of this M3 or pre-beta build. I think that Windows is such a fascinating product because there are so many different ways to be excited by it. Just take the way that we did the demos today. Julie showed a very end-user view of the product, and everybody in the room who were developers when they walked in the room became end-users while they were watching the demo. Then I moved over and showed some features that were very much about your development environment. I mean, do people remember the excitement over showing multi-mon capable remote desktop? Okay, so if you were to ask me to predict that, I put in the demo, so I knew people would like it. Did I think it was going to raise the roof like it did? Probably not. So I was excited to hear that. And if you think I was excited, the remote desktop team back in Redmond, I've gotten like 10 pieces of mail from them already. So they're very excited. And so it takes all types for Windows. And that's one of the most fun things about building it. I think that people who install the M3 build and also watch the keynote this morning are going to wish that they had all the user interface and everything, and are going to wish that the product was done already. It's not. We have a lot of work left to do. We're going to ship when we said we were going to ship. We're going to go to beta when we said we were going to go to beta. And we're going to focus on making sure the product is right when it comes to market. The thing that's exciting for me, just in terms of development, is that the build everybody got here today really is just this build from our engineering process. Like we said, we're going to finish M3, and that's going to be the one we're all going to install and use ourselves. And we just said, and we're going to give it to everybody else. In the past, we might have, oh my God, we have a conference, we need to do a build today. And we wouldn't have had the steps in engineering to reduce the change and the churn in the build and get it to a usable, hostable quality. And it really is. In fact, the really neat thing, too, is servicing also works in that build. So if we really want to do like a critical update, then we can. And in fact, we did. And when you install it, you'll get a critical update that we did earlier in the week for the entire Windows platform. The thing that's really important is that the update for Windows 7 and Windows Vista is less severe than the update for Windows XP and Windows 2000 because the vulnerability was not a take over your machine unattended kind of thing, because the security steps had sequenced it, or it had put in that defense. I'm going to switch sides because my neck is getting stiff. How's that?
So you will notice through a lot of the...
I'm going to move. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to do this.
Okay.
And then you have to run back to me.
All
How's
right.
that?
All right. So you had alluded to a lot of the performance updates you were trying to achieve with boot time and things like that. Have you made a decision to give a thought to cold starting .NET when the OS starts? Because that's been a sticking point for some of our apps as far as starting at boot time and taking a long time just for the framework to bootstrap.
Well, the thing about boot time, the most important thing to do about boot time, think of it. You imagine you're the BIOS, and you call this function called, winmain. It's a function that effectively computes a constant, zero. And so you would think it would take zero time to compute a constant. And so the real thing you have to do with boot time is not do anything that isn't absolutely necessary for the person to then go and presumably launch a program. So Windows, what we've done on the boot time is really focus on making sure we don't do things that aren't needed for Windows to function. So as one example that's in the M3 build is we've added a whole new service manager API. So services like services.msc services. And this API is not just what we currently have, which is manual or automatic start. It actually has triggered start. And so now services can start because of a specific event firing within Windows. So now all the services, a broad set of services can be start, not automatic, on a certain event. So an event like another program launching, an event like something happening in the event log, an event battery power changing, or things like that. And that's a way of starting even fewer services at boot. So the real answer to your question is, if Windows doesn't need it to boot and then start a program, we're not going to load it at boot time. And Windows doesn't need the .NET runtime to boot and start programs, so for you. However, you should go have a chat with Scott Guthrie and say, dude, when are you going to make this one a little bit faster and smaller? And that's the best way to answer that. Especially if you have to say dude. That's very important.
Is the opposite of that going to be true? Are we going to be able to shut down services on those events?
Yeah, the service manager does have a symmetrical event model to it. And there isn't a presentation here today, but that will certainly be by beta. You know, it'll be all documented and stuff like that.
Is upgrade and down?
Oh, sorry, I didn't repeat the question. Will the services also be able to shut down based on events?
Is upgrade in now, or is that beta, or
so is upgrade in now? Yeah, you can actually do an upgrade with this build, and it should accomplish the upgrade task. We'll see how that goes. That's not been a core testing scenario for this build. That's just not something we do this early. We do it all the time, and the coverage we have is pretty reasonable.
So if you were going to rebuild anyway, why not try it?
Well, I would assume the way I would do this, there's only two scenarios. I image a machine and then upgrade it, because I'm experimenting, or I just have another machine that I install this on. That's the only two ways to deal with the PDC build.
How much memory is Linsep going to occupy? What have you taken out of the Vista code base that's coming down?
How much memory is Windows 7 going to occupy, and what have we taken out of the code base? Well, I talked really today about the kinds of things that we've done, and so I don't really have a lot more to say about that right now because I want everybody to experience the build for themselves and to look at it. This build isn't the one to benchmark. It isn't the one to do. In fact, I know the code changes we've made from M3 to the beta milestone have all been significant in performance and user interface. You know, those things are things that happen at the top of the stack. And so, you know, time will unveil more of those accomplishments there. And we certainly haven't said the system requirements for this release or anything like that. It is worth pointing out that you know, that many of the low-priced PCs that we sometimes call netbooks, many of them also come with the option of using Vista on them today. So it's mostly what drove the challenges with Vista on these low-priced machines, where a small set of them wanted to use very small flash drives as their main storage. And you know, Vista doesn't install on it. I mean, its system requirements are about 20 gigabytes for the ultimate professional, in terms of total disk space, with about 16 gig free. And the reason for that is because we have a lot of scenarios in mind that use disk space, like the system restore functionality, Hibernate. I mean, if you put 2 gigs of RAM on a machine, you need 2 gigs of storage for Hibernate. Or we actually ship with over a gigabyte of printer drivers, just printer drivers. And that's so that you can be in a hotel room and plug a printer in and have it work. Now, you could argue, oh, that's not a good idea, I don't want those. But believe me, when you need it, you're really excited. And the ones that you really, really like are like the network, like a network driver. Like, say your wireless card conks out, you plug in a USB one, and you know, you have a machine without a CD drive, and so you plug in the USB one, and then having the drivers there is it, because you know, the last thing you want to see is searching the network for your driver. It's a network card. It's not going to find it. And so we ship with all those drivers, and that's a big service that we do for the whole ecosystem at large. And so it's easy to pick on the storage footprint, but that was sort of the primary driver on the system requirements. And so I think, you know, my hope is that everybody down the road, when we get to beta and we get to RTM and can start really trying out the product and seeing the specific, you know, memory footprint and things like that, you'll see some improvements that we really focused on getting. I mean, like I talked about, like just playing a DVD. So what do you think we do? We watch movies all day, and except we do it with a stopwatch and a watt meter. And we watch to see how we're doing to deliver on battery life from watching movies. Like, an interesting thing about movie watching is if we do it really well with hardware acceleration, we can actually save even more power showing the movie at progressive scan than we save power showing it interlaced, because we can work with the dedicated hardware that's really good at progressive scan display. And so there are really cool things that we can do for power management just by paying close attention.
Question, Stephen?
Sure. Oh, I'm right here. I can hear you.
Yeah, thank you. At a high level, Vista's been out there a while. Internally, we used it a lot for dog fooding and stuff before it went live. We've heard a fair amount of feedback, both positive and negative. What are kind of the top lessons learned about, you know, the development of Vista or getting it out to the market? How does that impact Microsoft going forward?
Well, it's a great question. I really did try to hit on that one in the discussion this morning. You know, as engineers, like, we're all about learning. Like, You know, people didn't know how to build really good bridges until bridges started falling. Like, you know, you have to, as engineers, you have to have some things that don't go as well as you would have liked, and you have to go and learn what to go prevent. And, you know, Vista, the first thing we did is put all those lessons to work with SP1. And certainly, I think the feedback across the industry has been, look, we agree, SP1 is fine, it works, it's got what we need in it, you really did deliver, you've got the device compatibility, you've got the ecosystem in place. And we just really weren't ready when the product RTM'd originally to consumers in January of 2007. And so, you know, we heard that. And we did a lot of work, and we just didn't do enough. We didn't do exactly the right kind of work. And so we had to go and improve things. And so that's sort of the kind of thing that we did. And I don't want to repeat the whole thing from this morning, but those are, I shared you with the lessons. And those lessons came out of the team. They came out of reading and learning and talking with customers and working with partners. And those are the lessons that we collectively internalized through a specific process, you know, where we wrote them all down and we said, these are the things we're going to go and make better. No repeats yet, so.
So you guys have a lot of.
You have to run back. That's how it works.
You guys have a lot of features, or rather.
A little closer to the mic.
New things that you're expecting. We could leverage new APIs, new capabilities we could do. But I'm guessing we'd have a hard time justifying taking the time to leverage those technologies if the market penetration of Windows 7 is as slow as the uptake has been for Vista. Yeah, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's not quite enough yet for us to... You know, do you have any reason to believe you might get faster pickup with Windows 7 than you did with Vista, or who knows at this point?
It's a really good question. You know, I'm a long-time PDC attendee. You know, way back in the day, I was sitting here. We didn't do open space, but I was doing speeches about doing the Microsoft Foundation classes and building C++ programs for Windows. And I certainly understand, you know, sort of this addressable market kind of argument. And the thing that we've learned over the years is that really there are two dynamics in place. One is, if I deliver something to you as Windows that you think is really cool, we actually don't have the conversation about the addressable market. You just go, this is really cool. I will build a better, cooler product if I can take advantage of this. And we have lots of history of that. Windows 3, Windows 95, Windows 2000. Those are operating systems that were big step functions in capability and didn't have an installed base to go work with. And so that's the first thing. The other thing is that the true addressable market is often much smaller than the installed base. Because somebody running Windows XP today, it might not be out in the market for more software anytime soon. They might not actually be saying, hey, what new things can I buy today? They might be waiting for the hinge on their laptop to finally snap off, so they'll go buy a new machine. Now, that doesn't mean you always have to assume the latest and greatest. And we'll have very specific features that we deliver so that you can put those on Windows Vista. And two of those are going to be the ribbon and the DirectX functionality. And so we'll make it possible for you to deliver those on down-level Vista customers. But we are strategically convinced that we have to do great features that make it so that you go, oh, I get this, and I'm really willing to do the math and realize that I can't really sell this into this installed base because it's so cool that I want to do it, and they're not going to be buying a lot of new software or anyway. And it's not an all or nothing. I mean, it's a gradient, but it is an important point for us. And I also think that the installed base is a huge number. It can't snap. And you know, for years of working on Office, we always talked about that when we release a new version of Office, people are on the current one, the one before it, and the one before it. Always. And that's always been the case. And one of the things that I hope that we can deliver to you, and Steve Ballmer has said this quite a bit, is that we want people to know that Windows is on a regular cadence of releases. Now, I'm not promising anything, committing to any time frames or anything like that. But I am saying that we want to learn as we build Windows 7 to get good as an engineering team at being predictable and reliable as a partner to you. And once that happens, one of the things that's going to happen is people are going to be on a variety of Windows releases at any given time. Maybe time for one more, I think, and we're going to start to run out of time, so sure.
I don't know if you addressed this before I was here, but you spoke a little bit of the UAC and some of the difficulties there, and that was difficult, but it almost sounded like you were saying, but we're still going to do the same thing. And I have actually reached points where it's been difficult for me as someone who knows what's going on in these operating systems to even get things done. It becomes difficult. And, you know, I don't know when I'm in administrative mode some times, things like that. And, you know, are you sticking with the same type of policies, or are you manipulating that in any way? And then my other question would be the other side of it, with the folder virtualization and stuff like that, are you going to continue that type of thing.
Those aren't related in any way, are they?
No. No,
okay.
I just
had
two questions.
Okay. Let me ask this of folks here in the spirit of this discussion we're having. How many of you think UAC is really annoying for you personally as a user? Okay. So notice that we're still less than half. How many of you think definitely annoying for me, but I'm actually think it's okay for my friends who aren't in the PC industry and aren't developers and stuff like that? So how many think that's kind of okay? What?
The other way around, I would say.
That it's more annoying for your friends?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, I'll take that. Don't get a lot of that. Our blog, we got a lot of people saying, the reason I ask is so I thought many of you read the blog, and we had a lot of comments that said, I hate it, but boy, it's really saving my butt because my brother is an idiot. And
is that annoying for, not good for?
As annoying. Is it as annoying? Did I get the question backwards and that confused you?
It annoys them because they don't know what's going on, they don't know why, but it's good for them.
Ah.
It's keeping them safe.
Okay, so I'll ask again for the sake of the video record. Is it annoying yet good for them? Okay, so a resounding yes.
I'm just going to argue it's potentially bad for them. They have the illusion that it's more secure because of it, but they turn it off.
Well, turning it off isn't a very large set of people. The question was, it's annoying, but it's so annoying they turn it off. But the reality is, as we know from the telemetry, that it's not turned off by a large set of people. We tried to do some really detailed blog posts on the E7 blog about UAC. So what I would say is the data really supports a conclusion that we've substantially reduced the number of prompts that people see. And we've done that through two ways. One is most software now is capable of running day-to-day, not without elevation required. And that's not anything we did. That's the ecosystem saying, you know what? It's probably a good idea to run a standard user. And second, we've done an SP1. We addressed a few of the more annoying ones that probably didn't need to be there. And in Windows 7, we're going to do two things. We're going to continue to make sure that we were really precise in the places that we wanted to remove, that we don't really think require elevation. And we put in a user interface that you can tune, if you want, with that slider control. But the reality is it really does, if you run your machine as standard user, that's the best thing you can do. If you don't, the elevations that you see even running as an administrator, whether they're annoying or people have numbed themselves out, they do work, and we can see that in the way that malware writers have responded, in the ways that people are dealing with security on their PCs. So I don't think we're going to get rid of it. We think we've actually successfully, together as an ecosystem, moved forward, because we think the right thing to do is if you want to muck with the machine, you should at least be able to know that you're doing that and that you have the rights to it. And I think we've addressed the feedback points that are super important. You'll see a lot of this in the pre-beta, and I think you'll see substantially fewer elevations, and those that happen make sense. And if you truly are like doing dev on the machine, just ratchet the slider down. A quick follow-up, and I think we're going to have to call it quits on time because the room is occupied.
I think you guys made some really good progress in what you showed with the adjustability. Are you considering any other knobs you can turn, such as I want it disabled for 10 minutes or something
yeah.
like that?
We looked at a lot of different ways to adjust it. We actually had for a while this design about a time-based thing. Actually, Outlook does that for the automation model. We just didn't think that one really worked. It didn't quite. Things like that, those aren't really you being in control of your PC. Because you don't really know, you don't have an internal timer. And it's also a really obvious thing for something to exploit. Like, you get elevated, and if you trick the person into elevating you, you know you have free reign to elevate again and again for... And so it's not safe at all. Look, I want to thank you guys for joining us today, and I want to thank Jason for setting up OpenSpace, and thank all the PDC folks for helping out. And so thank you, and good luck with installing the build and having fun with it. So thanks a lot.